The following is an audio podcast of the New York Military Affairs Symposium. Other podcasts and full-text resources are available at the NIMAS website at nimas.org. This podcast is a telephone interview hosted by Jim Dingman of the NIMAS Board of Directors with Wayne White, former Deputy Director of the State Department's Bureau of Intelligence and Research's Office of Analysis for the Near East and South Asia. Mr. White also served on the Iraq Study Group. The podcast was recorded on March 31st of 2008 and is approximately 33 minutes in length.
We're joined with Wayne White, who's a former official of the State Department. He joins us from his home in Pennsylvania. And Wayne, we're very happy to have you with us today. Wayne, thank you for joining us.
My pleasure, Jim.
Wayne, first of all, tell us what your assessment of the surge is. What is going on there?
Well, one problem is terminology. A lot of people associate the success we've had in taking our casualties way down in predominantly Sunni Arab areas of the country as relating to the surge. It has virtually nothing to do with the surge. This was done on the part of Iraqi Sunni Arabs who wanted to get rid of al-Qaeda in Iraq. The surge was directed at the greater Baghdad area. 80 to 90% of forces went in there. They didn't go out there into Sunni Arab areas. The Iraqis basically started this whole thing. And in fact, the Iraqis who did this had wanted to do this, partner up with U.S. forces against al-Qaeda since 2004. But we wouldn't take them up on the deal, understandably, because they despised and mistrusted the Shia-dominated central government and wouldn't make a deal with them. And so finally, in desperation, in late 06, with all the violence, ethno-sectarian cleansing and what have you, we took the deal. Huh. And once we took the deal, the awakening could just start emerging all over Sunni Arab areas and shutting down a lot of al-Qaeda operations. So one of the first things you have to talk about is what was done by the surge and what wasn't. And I'd say probably 80% of what we see on the ground as progress has nothing to do with the surge. Now, for your question, sorry for all the background, but I think because that is the major issue, the awakening, these controlled local citizen groups in Sunni Arab areas, which are made up of former insurgents, tribal elements, and others, who have now stood up to a strength of about 100,000 fighters, with the United States allowing them to arm and organize themselves, there's a problem. We've done very well in hammering al-Qaeda in Iraq into some enclaves in the far north and expelling them from pretty much two entire governates. But the problem is that the people who did it are still estranged from the government. The government is hostile to them and they to the government. And to the extent that we continue withdrawing, we will be allowing these people to come in direct contact with government security forces, which have fought them on occasion. So this is a double-edged sword. And in fact, General Petraeus was asked recently, what keeps you up at night, if there's anything like that, regarding security in Iraq? And he said, the future of the concerned local citizen groups, you know, and reconciliation between them and the government. Hmm. So he's concerned. And when he's concerned, I'm concerned.
Now, we have this fighting going down in Basra right now. There seems to be today a call by Muqtada al-Sadr for a ceasefire of sorts. What's your assessment of all that?
Well, it's really a mess. From what I understand yesterday, listening to General Hayden, Maliki did not even have the courtesy to inform the U.S. that he was going to unleash a campaign against Sadr, especially in the Basra area, using government security forces. It would have been nice to have known about all this. Apparently, according to, I believe, General Hayden, even General Petraeus was not tipped off that this was going to start. And predictably, since the Iraqi army has considerable loyalty problems, meaning that the army itself is filled with malicious sympathizers of one type or another, the army did not perform well against the Mahdi army of Sadr. The whole operation stalled. As of today, Sadr holds more of Basra than he did before the operation started. after not telling us in the beginning about even doing this, Maliki had to desperately appeal to us for air support and anything else that could try to tip the balance in favor of government forces. Even that didn't work. And so finally, he must have sent a signal out that he was ready for a deal. And the Iranians were the ones who brokered it, to everyone's astonishment.
Now, in terms of the background to this crisis, much is made of the battles going over inside in the parliament about the question of what kind of sharing of power should occur. And some argue that in the background to all this is, some will use the term ethno-federalism. In other words, that part of this is a battle over who will control the South. Will a Shiite-type state, a Shiistan, if you will, be created? What do you make of all that, the arguments that there's been this constant fight about the interpretation of the Constitution and rewriting it, that's the background to this particular move by Maliki right now in Basra?
It could be, you know, Jim, eventually, that what's written in the Constitution isn't going to matter as much as facts on the ground. On the ground, the facts are that most of the South and much of Baghdad is controlled by Shia militias. The government's authority outside the green zone is paper thin. Even where people technically hold government jobs, they're affiliated with the Dawa Party, the Shia Party of al-Hakim, or one of the other factions. And then you have vast areas of the Sunni Arab portions of Iraq that are controlled by the Sahwa, or concerned local citizens. And then up in the north in Kurdistan, you have either Kurdish Peshmerga, their version of a militia, or army units recruited exclusively from Kurds who we know are very, very closely aligned with the Peshmerga. So the federal government has very little authority. And so one has to ask right up front, how much authority does it have to divvy up? It would seem that a lot of it's already been divvied up. The thing that frightens many of us is that even though Iraq is divided along ethno-sectarian lines, and even within those groups there are divisions, is that a lot of the population is mixed. Some very large cities in Iraq are mixed. Mosul is mixed. Baghdad is mixed, less so than before because of the ethnic cleansing. Many other towns and areas are mixed. And a lot of these areas did not get unmixed back in the fearsome fighting in 2006-2007 between Sunni and Shia. And if the facts on the ground continued moving in the direction they are now, we are going to see ethno-sectarian divides, but some of that division is going to be rather brutal.
Hmm. Now, we also have reports that there have actually been, since the fighting began last week, desertions and mutinies within the Iraqi security forces fighting against the Maqdi army. In some cases, elements of the security forces have gone over weapons in hand to the Maqdi army. Others have simply deserted. What's your assessment of the loyalty, how this deals with the whole question of the loyalty of the security forces that we've been basing our strategy on for the past couple of years and building up?
It's huge, and this problem is huge, the problem of loyalty. In fact, when I was advising the Iraq Study Group, it came up as a major issue. As the government, our administration, kept harping on the training of Iraqi forces, there were a few of us who kept emphasizing training is not your problem. A lot of these people have been trained already. They were part of the Iraqi army. They know how to shoot. It's not a problem. They know how to be members of an organization, a military organization. It's loyalty. Will they fight for a government in Baghdad? Or are they really only loyal to their ethnic or sectarian community? And unfortunately, what the fighting in the South shows us is that Shia generally don't like to kill Shia. And in fact, even some army units were filled with many sympathizers of Sadr's own, Maqdi army. And these are probably the ones who went over. But there probably are a lot of other Shia who simply won't, you know, shoot at other Shia, or would prefer instead to fight Sunnis. That's another problem. That's why I say when we separate, when we withdraw and are no longer in a position to separate or sit on certain sectarian areas that abut each other, that are different, fighting could just break out. The Iraqi army is not a national institution. to the extent that it is allowed to come into direct contact, for example, with the Sunni Arab concerned local citizen cadres, there's going to be fighting because a lot of these are former insurgents and many of them have blood on their hands, and it could be very, very ugly. Some of our withdrawals have fortunately been, or most of our withdrawals have been focused on non-mixed areas that are Sunni Arab and are under control of the CLCs, which means that when you pull out of an area like that, you don't leave two different sectarian groups abutting each other. But we did pull out 2,000 people from Baghdad recently, and shortly afterward, we saw a spike in the violence in the city. That might be a lesson to us. We should be careful about pulling out of mixed areas.
Before Basra thrust itself back into the media, we had the whole process of the British operating in that particular sector, and essentially reports indicating that essentially they were defeated in the south, that they, because of the lack of success they had with their counterinsurgency program, more or less decided to call it quits, to declare victory, and retreat into the Basra airfield, where their brigade is right now, and where we understand the United States initially, as this offensive began, was calling for the British to reinvolve themselves, which of course is going to come up against the domestic political process in England. But explain to the audience what happened down there. Why did the British fail? Or what is your assessment of that that sort of comment about the British effort in the south?
What happened to the British down there was almost predictable. They were very thin on the ground. The idea was that the British, the real bottom line was that the British were to keep the south in hand, along with other coalition contingents like the Italians, Poles, who have largely since left, until government authority could be extended to the area. Instead, government authority never really took hold. Instead, militias took hold in the south, and the British never took them on. And so what has happened down there in Basra in the last week was sort of the culmination of the buildup of militia power throughout the south over the past several years. The British didn't really have a counterinsurgency strategy. The British essentially watched as militias, almost like termites, ate out the state structure in the south and became the state.
Interesting. Now, we know that also the British Brigade down there was engaged from June of 2007 in approximately 500 firefights. And this is before the ceasefire that Muqtada al-Sadr announced in 2007. And was, in some cases, elements of it were nearly overrun by the Mahdi army and the fighting down there. And it raises the question of why now does Maliki want to press this? Because we saw reports that the general who was in command in Basra and the police commander down there did not want to have this crackdown that Maliki has put in place. They wanted to have a disarmament that would take 6 months, not 72 hours. Why do you think Maliki is pushing this now?
It's unclear, Jim. Maliki sits on top or sits amidst a boiling pot of competing Shia factions. The Al-Hakim group that was affiliated with Iran, his own Dawa party, the Fadila militia, which is very, very strong down in Basra, is very localized, then they also mock the army of Muqtada al-Sadr. One problem that Maliki had in cracking down on Sadr, aside from Sadr's street power, this guy has tremendous popular street power. He appeals to the unemployed, to the blue-collar workers, what the Shia call the dispossessed. His fierce demeanor is very impressive to people at the bottom of the economic ladder, have very little religious knowledge themselves. They don't care so much that he doesn't have great religious credentials. Anyway, Maliki actually came to power with the support of Muqtada al-Sadr to show how tortured these politics are, and resisted attempts to crack down on him for at least a year and a half because he still was leaning on Muqtada al-Sadr. What turned him around, I'm not quite sure. But what seems to have happened is that the group under Hakim, which was the original old Iraq, Iraqi resistance group based in Iran, which
this
is very
the Supreme Islamic
ground.
Council of Iraq.
Exactly. That's what its old name is. It's actually got a new name now because it's trying to get away from its old exile name. Not that it didn't want to remind people about its period of time in Iran during the Iran-Iraq War. Anyway, it has grown very powerful in parliament, and I can only assume that Maliki has now decided to lean more heavily on the Hakim, and in order to do so, he had to turn against Sadr. There was a time, about a year and a half ago, where the United States actively tried to do this too, tried to wean Maliki off of Sadr and onto al-Hakim. Hakim was invited to the White House, you remember, back in that time, and that didn't go over very well and didn't work. But for some reason, he's moved against Sadr. I would say because the Hakim people, in order to continue giving him support, demanded that he take action against Sadr's forces, who have grown significantly in the south since the surge. People talk about a success for the surge. One of the things the surge did was force a lot of Sadr's people to move south to get away from U.S. forces. When they moved south, they became far stronger down there and started disrupting sort of an equilibrium that had been in existence among the Fadila group, among al-Hakim's people, and the Mahdi army of Sadr. Now that equilibrium had been disrupted. And probably this, in some way, taking it all the way back to its origins, relates to the surge. The fact that rather than fight the U.S. forces when they came into the capital in beginning in late 2006, Sadr decided to have the people still there lay low, and most of the people, many thousands of his fighters, go south. And within months of the beginning of the surge, Basra exploded in militia battles between Sadr's people coming south and the Fadila militia that controlled much of Basra before.
Okay, now the other issue is that in the backdrop to this is this constant debate in the United States, which the National Intelligence Estimate last year essentially appeased somewhat. That is the question of Iran's nuclear capability and the argument of some that we should go to war with Iran. And now we had recently Admiral Fallon resigning because Esquire did an article about him that essentially talked about how Admiral Fallon was one of the roadblocks still existing within the administration against such an operation. Now, what do you make of what Iran is actually doing on the ground in the south? What is your assessment of that? Are they intervening? What's the nature of their intervention? And how do you see that in the light of that kind of debate going on in the body politic here in the country?
My assessment is that ever since 2003, Iran has been gun running to Shia militias, amazingly. And initially, they didn't do that with Sadr, because they regarded him as hyper-ambitious, very young, unpredictable, potentially very dangerous, and they were still had their money on the old Skiri group, al-Hakim's group.
Who they had backed during the Iran-Iraq War.
Absolutely. It was a long relationship. It goes all the way back to the early 1980s. Sadr was an unknown quantity to the Iranians, but by late 2003, early 2004, when I was still in government, we got very solid reporting that the Iranians very reluctantly realized he was so large, had become so large on the Iraqi scene that they had to put some money on him. And since then, he's grown even larger, and the Iranians have, you know, been compelled to lock in their policy appropriately inside of Iraq. So I see the Iranians right now sort of straddling al-Hakim's group and Sadr's. Almost 50-50 as far as provision of support, although it's very hard to sort out because it's covert. One thing that the negotiated agreement here shows, that the government in Baghdad is so weak inside of Iraq, you know, Maliki, that the Iranian government, which of course is a coherent national government, is viewed as far more credible, and the Iraqi government in this sort of deal is being viewed as probably not much more than another militia, and that the Iranians, therefore, can step forth and be peacemakers.
In the past few weeks, we've had sort of a love fest by those who advocated the surge. The American Enterprise Institute hosted the fourth annual report of the Iraq Study Group with Fred Kagan, Mike O'Hanlon, and Ken Pollack talking about how they feel so enthused that the surge has succeeded so well. What do you make of all that? What's your assessment of those in Washington who, in the case of Kagan, confessed in that particular meeting that he didn't care or did not know much about Iraqi society, end of quote, in making his assessments? What do you make of all that?
Well, I heard that quote, and it said it all. The reason people like Kagan think the surge has succeeded is mainly because they don't understand Iraq. They don't understand the fractured ethno-sectarian politics, very violent ethno-sectarian politics of Iraq. The surge hasn't succeeded. In fact, the surge wasn't responsible for most of the success. Therefore, there are reasons to be very concerned about the situation on the ground coming up as we pull out as the only honest broker on the ground with guns in Iraq. As people come together in mixed areas, armed units of Iraqis of different sectarian groups, we are going to have violence. And Petraeus is very worried, and people like Kagan had ought to get worried as well, because the surge never really worked beyond Baghdad. We pushed a lot of people in there. We sat on a lot of people in Baghdad. We got the violence down, but mainly we made a deal with the devil, with these anti-government Sunni Arab armed groups to take out al-Qaeda and to leave us alone and for us to leave them alone. That is not a solution. In other words, effectively, we took down a vicious and dangerous insurgency, al-Qaeda in Iraq, by allowing another potentially dangerous insurgency to stand up. That is not a really good solution.
Now, finally, you have the...
Isn't that ironic?
Yeah, it is. Finally, you have the issue of the question of withdrawal going on in the presidential election. And my personal feeling is that whether the Democrats, if the Democrats win, I doubt very much that their policy initially will be that different from Bush's. But for argument's sake, we see that Obama and Clinton have varying plans of withdrawal. Obama perhaps is a little faster, at least in the rhetoric, before getting into office. McCain, of course, is wedded to the Bush policy, his famous comment, we're involved in a new 100 years war, et cetera. What do you actually make of all that? What do you think is really going to happen in terms of these kind of questions of withdrawal or not withdrawing from Iraq? And, of course, we have the wider question of Afghanistan, which seems to be deteriorating, especially after the political changes in Pakistan with a new coalition government coming in with a mandate to negotiate with the Taliban a peace process inside Afghanistan. So what do you make of all that?
Well, Afghanistan has become a problem made far worse by our focus on Iraq. This is one of the reasons why we never should have gone in Iraq, because Afghanistan has been starved of resources. The Europeans haven't really stepped up to the plate, the NATO powers, in providing not only enough troops, but enough troops that could engage in combat, full combat-capable forces. Inside of Iraq, you know, regardless of how things develop, and I think they're not going to develop well, gradually we're going to find out that stabilization hasn't occurred, and we're dealing with a maelstrom of Sunni Arab, Kurdish, and Shia militias whirling around a very weak and fragile central government, much as we have now, but the maelstrom hasn't really started whirling as much with so many American troops on the ground. But one thing that's going to check in here, if the economy keeps going the way it is right now, is we can't afford to keep our troops there. That could become huge. You know, when people write history books 30 years from now about Iraq and the Iraq War, they may consider it as important on the economic side as on the military side, in the sense that we have bled away hundreds of billions of dollars we do not have, and in the coming years certainly will not have, in order to maintain a large presence there. And so I have a feeling that even if McCain is elected president, he's going to have to swallow hard at some point in his presidency and start getting people out of there just because of the sheer cost of it.
We had recently Linda Bilmes and Stiglitz publish a book that sort of codifies their arguments that the war, all the costs of the war in Iraq will cost $3 trillion. That was, of course, contested by the White House. The GAO came out with different reports. But in the background of all this, we have the whole subprime mortgage crisis sifting through the economy. Some estimate the cost will be $600 to $800 billion, which is far, far greater than the savings and loans crisis of the 80s, which actually Senator McCain, because he was one of the Keating Five, the $3.5 billion loss that was, was associated with a far, far greater hit. What is that? How does that all factor in to this whole policy debate about Iraq and Afghanistan and the global war on terror?
It may determine how long we stay in Iraq, regardless of who becomes president. Because with the weight of the subprime mortgage crisis weighing down upon the U.S. budget, with other ramifications that might also hurt us economically, falling dollar, what are we going to be deciding in Iraq when the dollar is $2 to the euro, or maybe even three, if things get really bad? I think that $600 or $800 billion, which was the amount you attached to the subprime mortgage crisis, will roughly be a conservative estimate of the price of the Iraq war, if you take it out about another 18 months. That's a huge hit, and we can't afford to keep bleeding away that money, and that's going to be a compelling factor in all decision-making related to Iraq as we get further and further into a rather troubled economic period. The president may have to consider that as much as he does military issues in the mix of policymaking.
Now, there's always this analogy with Vietnam and Iraq, and one of the things that's brought up is that the Bush administration may be seeding a casus belli to initiate an air campaign like what was initiated by Lyndon Johnson in 65, 66, flaming dart, then rolling thunder. And we see the skirmishing in the Gulf between the Revolutionary Guard Corps Navy elements, or the Iranian Navy elements, and the American fleet. And then, of course, we have this latest situation in Basra where some argue that the United States will bring into the fold the question of the mobile groups of the Muqtada al-Sadr army that they claim are being trained by the Iranian Revolutionary Guard Corps, and also the question of enhanced armor penetrators, et cetera. How do you feel that issue is playing out? Do you think that that level of irrationality could be something coming out of this administration or not?
Unknown. It appeared that the question of military action against Iran was dead. I mean, heavy-handed military action against Iran's nuclear infrastructure and a lot of its retaliatory capabilities in the Gulf, which would have to go too if you went in there. You can't go hit Iran and then let Iran remain in possession of vast arrays of ballistic and anti-ship missiles with which to hammer back at you, potentially, and your bases and your allies across the Gulf. You got to take it all out. And this is what the military told Bush back in 2006, and that gave him considerable pause. Then came the estimate, which, whether right or wrong, took the air out of the balloon even more so.
This is the National Intelligence Estimate of last fall.
This is the November 2007 Iran estimate that said that Iran had stopped its weapons program in 2003. Although there's a dissent in that estimate on the part of my old boss, Tom Finger, saying that as chairman of the NIC, he and the Energy Department, which has a lot of the nuclear labs, are less confident that all of the program was shut down, and I am too less confident that all the program was shut down because of gaps in intelligence. And so it didn't exactly say it go as far as some people say it did. But in any case, it raises two questions have come up subsequently. One, the Israelis were essentially relying on the United States to carry the water on Iran. They can't do that anymore. And the Israelis, I can tell you, are more seriously considering their own military options with respect to Iran. And at the distance that they would have to strike Iran, they would not be able to take out any of Iran's retaliatory capabilities. They would just bore tunnels to the target, take out a few anti-aircraft capabilities, some air, and hit a few of the keynotes of the program, and then leave. And we could, and for a long period of time after the strike, hours and hours, the Iranians might not even know who hit them, since the Israelis like us would hit them at night. The Iranians, therefore, might swat out at us. So the Israelis have to be factored into this whole thing. Now, Fallon was a strong opponent of this particular thing, of going after Iran, but so are the Joint Chiefs and most of the military brass over at the Pentagon, and so the administration still has considerable opposition. I would hazard a guess, having taken his measure a bit, while a member of the ISG, that not so much from what he said, just his bearing and what how he's worked as SecDef since, that Gates is probably somewhat cautious and influenced by the military brass on this. And so whether we're going to do anything with Iran is still up in the air, and I would say less than 50-50 all around.
We also have this occurring at a certain point in the presidential campaign in the United States, where it's obviously that the Republican Party is making this, in terms of McCain's campaign, a central piece of his campaign. That is, that I was the one in favor of sending troops ahead of time. I was the one advocating the surge. Hence, I was right all along. And if we cave in to the wimpy Democrats, we're going to get a defeat. What do you make of how this issue is inserting itself into the campaign?
Well, for a while, I think the Democrats felt that they had been rocked on their heels, maintaining that only a withdrawal would really be worth executing, considering the appalling conditions in the country in 06 and 07, only to see things stabilize in large measure, or at least appear to stabilize, and McCain apparently being vindicated. But that's a very simplistic picture, and I find Democrats and Republicans both have a lack of understanding of what's really going on out there. Nothing really became stable. We allowed, in effect, by accepting this conditional deal with anti-government Sunni Arab elements to go fight al-Qaeda in Iraq, we accepted a situation in which we were really allowing a large and potentially very dangerous anti-government Sunni Arab militia to take form. And as we thin out on the ground and are not, again, in position to separate this huge militia from government forces that are mainly Shia, we could see a steady rise in violence as the campaign proceeds. And this is one reason why Dave Petraeus is coming here next month to ask for a halt in U.S. withdrawals. He can see that stability has not been achieved, and to the extent that he thins out on the ground and pulls out of areas, we're going to see a rebound in violence. In fact, we're seeing it already because he's already withdrawn some people.
Huh. Well, on that note, we want to thank Wayne White, former official of the State Department, for joining us and sharing his thoughts on Iraq today. Thank you so much for joining us, Wayne.
My pleasure, Jim.
You've been listening to an audio podcast of the New York Military Affairs Symposium. This podcast was an interview hosted by Jim Dingman of the NIMAS Board of Directors with Wayne White, former Deputy Director of the State Department's Bureau of Intelligence and Research's Office of Analysis for the Near East and South Asia. Mr. White also served on the Iraq Study Group. The podcast was recorded on March 31st of 2008 and was approximately 33 minutes in length.